This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Australia's number one award-winning show for exploring sex, sexuality, and self.
Hide and seek.
Visit joy.org.au/hide and seek. Good afternoon, good evening, and good day to you one and all. This is Hide and Seek. It is your show for exploring sex, sexuality and self. I'm Dean Beck, and joining me tonight is Tim Little. Welcome.
Good evening.
Tonight is going to be an interesting show. It's always tough to talk about drugs, but specifically tough tonight, and we'll tell you why a little later. But we're going to be talking about party drugs. We're going to be talking about prescription drugs. And we're going to talk about the potential for overdose. It is party season.
Definitely.
And the warmer weather. I mean, were you at a certain party last weekend?
I was indeed.
You were, right. You and a few others.
With the rest of Melbourne.
Yes, apparently. How was it?
Oh, it was interesting. It was good.
Okay.
Very sexy party, actually.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's a tick in that box then.
Certainly.
Great topics, great radio.
Hide and Seek.
Touching our community. Right around the nation.
Hide and Seek.
Reaching far and wide. Stream us now. Joy 94.9.
You are on Hide and Seek on Joy, and it is a night where we're going to talk about things that are, for some people, very challenging. So if a very frank and open discussion about drug use in our community is going to offend you or little ears nearby, then I suggest you rejoin us after 10 p.m. this evening. I have a little story to tell. Last Saturday, I got home from actually Joy's podcasting Christmas party thing, and I did a few things here before I went home. And I went into my apartment. It was looked all very normal. Went out, got a pizza, got something to drink, brought that back to the apartment, finished all that. And then I thought, I haven't heard from my flatmate for a while. So I checked in on him and found him deceased. And the coroner will adjudicate as to what the final reasons for that are. But I believe, and those close to him believe, that it was an accidental case of prescription medications and of party drugs, of crystal. A combination of those things over a prolonged period of time, prescription medications which he'd been on for many, many years, and it just seemed to all come to an end. So it raised some thoughts for me, and I thought, with our community going into party season, it is, you know, the next 2 or 3 months, it's chock-a-block full of parties, it might be worth our while having a pretty frank discussion with a man who knows a little bit about this stuff. His name is Bill O'Loughlin. He's the president of Harm Reduction Victoria, and Bill joins us on Hide and Seek. Welcome.
Thanks, Dean. Nice to be here.
Thank you very much for making yourself available today. Tell us a little bit about Harm Reduction Victoria, because they're kind of different.
Well, kind of different, but in places like this, I equate it with VAC. It's a community-based organisation, and it's essentially a community-based organisation of people in Victoria who use drugs. Historically, it came out of a response to the HIV epidemic in the 80s, and it was around promoting safe injecting practices amongst opiate users. Mm-hmm. And since then, it's broadened, and it takes in a cross-section, I suppose, of different forms of drug use in different communities. So we've been in the media a lot lately around dance music festivals and pill testing, where we have teams working as volunteers there.
Did it form at that time when we were seeing a lot of deaths due to heroin?
No, it formed because we knew that injecting was one of the major transmission routes for HIV.
Sure, yep.
The deaths from heroin came a little bit later in my memory.
Right.
But it was very much a public health thing around HIV, which then managed to capitalise on that. And one of the major things we do is safer injecting, overdose workshops, and distributing naloxone, which will reverse the effects of an overdose.
Yeah, there's not reversing medications for every overdose, is there?
No, unfortunately, naloxone works just with opiates.
Yeah, yeah.
but no. And the example you raised, I think, is one that is, I think a lot of people talk about particular drugs as though people just use one drug at a time once, whereas we know that a lot of people will use a range of drugs.
And has the landscape changed much since then, since the 80s when you formed?
Oh, dramatically.
In what way?
The kinds of drugs that are around have changed. So, for example, you know, I'm a little bit old. I can remember when speed was first common. I remember when ease first appeared. I remember when people first started injecting. Back then, the production of drugs was more stable, so that the kind of drugs that were around, like E and that, were pretty consistent and regular. What's changed in the last little while is the it's a lot of drug production coming out of Southwest China, a little bit out of India. They are tweaking the chemical components of the drug all the time.
The raw ingredients?
Yep.
Or, right,
yep.
Okay.
So, and that's particularly around sort of hallucinogenic type drugs. They are using very smart marketing to it's all happening on the internet. People can order them online and get them in the mail within a couple of days in an envelope that just passes through customs without detecting. And the difficulty here is, in back in the day, to go back to your question, Tim, there was a reasonable consistency about the drugs we were getting. You know, we knew the dealers and whatever their supply was. Now it's wide open. So the potency of the drug is the unknown question now.
What worries me is that many of what is sold as one thing is actually a synthetic manufactured thing that does kind of the same thing. So as a consumer, if you have a pleasant experience, you're not going to complain about the outcome, but you don't necessarily or can't be guaranteed a pleasant experience each and every time.
Oh, precisely. In fact, they did some testing in South Australia a handful of years ago where they did use quite sophisticated machines, and they found that, I've read it and I can't remember the details, they found that the components of the drug varied quite a lot from what people thought they were getting.
Yeah.
They also found some people who thought their drugs were really powerful and effective, and in fact they'd been taking paracetamol, but that's another...
It's very interesting.
Yeah, so
and
the power of the mind.
I've heard of stories of you know, what is being sold as MDA is really what was sold in the UK 5 years ago as Meow Meow.
Yes.
And because it's in a you know, if it's in a capsule, it's in such a small dose that we're not seeing the issues that they were having over there, because it's kind of measured, I guess, you know.
You mean there's a small amount of it available,
yes,
or something?
Yeah, well, a small amount in a capsule rather than, you know, over there they were selling it in bagfuls.
Yes, yes. I think what we're talking about is the fact is that the wide variety and range of drugs that are on the market at the moment, and I say the market very deliberately because this is kind of capitalism at its smartest. What is happening now is very sophisticated. There's a huge range out there. People can go online. They can look at what other users' comments or, you know, reviews of the qualities, and they can do their ordering in very simple ways and quite direct ways.
They can buy them from many adult bookshops.
That's another form of what's available as well. Yes.
And I know there's been a lot of publicity recently with regards to Stereosonic, for example, some overdoses that have happened. Does there seem to be more of a push now for installing testing at dance parties, for example?
Look, one of the phenomena we have to look at is why these overdoses occurred. And one of the features in there is that police have a pretty heavy presence of those, and they have sniffer dogs. And we know that people tend to binge a bit with their drugs, but they will also panic at the sight of the drugs. And so some of the, I think there's been 5 deaths in Australia at events like this in the last year.
Where they swallowed them.
They swallow them, but they swallow them in panic because they see the police dogs there.
Oh, my God.
And it's also a little bit popular in most circles to take more than one tablet.
Yeah, I have heard those stories
and get,
you know,
a blast.
Up to 10 at a time and all that sort of stuff.
So we're quite clear that the machines that do this pill testing cost about $50,000. You have a doctor that runs them. You work in conjunction with one of our team that are members of the community that are trained to give you information. And within 20 minutes, you can tell someone what the content of the drug is. And the studies have shown that people will actually not take the drug if they trust the people that are doing the testing, giving the information.
There are plenty of sort of home test type things available. Are they any good?
Yes, but they're very simple. They're what are called reagent tests, right, and they are much simpler and not as sophisticated as other tests. So there's a lot of people now purchasing these reagent tests as at least something they can do to get a little bit of an indication about the quality of their drugs.
Sure.
And if you don't have that, you're basically buying a white circle or a pink circle or whatever it is from a random person and trusting their good intentions.
And it's this...
And handing over money for it.
And it's this bigger picture thing of, you know, the way drugs operate in our community is you get them from someone and you sort of think, oh, well, you know, I trust him. But it's an absurd proposition, really, because we have no way of actually knowing what's going on.
Yeah, it's the relationship, I guess, between a dealer and a consumer is an interesting one in itself, isn't it?
Yes, and we're also, to go back to the story you sadly began with, you know, dealers are also now providing a range of drugs as well. So they might sell you your crystal, but they'll also sell you some Valium or some antidepressant or something, some sedative to help you come down at the other end of it. So the dealers are becoming more sophisticated and kind of offering a range of services to their customers.
Or Viagra.
Yes, and Viagra, of course. Yes.
Yeah. When you think about that, these are people dealing in prescription medications, which is highly illegal, you know.
Yeah, but it makes sense. If you want to go out and have a wild weekend and use a lot of crystal, you know that you're going to crash after a couple of days and it's going to be rough. So if at the same time as you're purchasing that crystal, you can purchase some Valium and some sedatives, makes sense.
It's Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. We'd like to hear from you. Perhaps you've got something to contribute to the conversation. Have you had an experience? You don't have to use your real name, but just make up a name. We'll use a name if you put it there. tell us what your experience has been in this space, because we think by having these conversations, we can hopefully avert some rather tragic outcomes. 0427 Joy 949 is the SMS, or you can email us on air at joy.org.au. Bill, your organisation does go out into these dance parties and keeps an eye on people. I've seen them do stuff at a Pride March one year that at the end of the evening it was all getting a little bit, you know, there was sun, lots of booze, and then people started to drop and I could see them. And I watched your streetwise people...
Dancewise
people.
They also going streetwise.
going around and just checking on them. And, you know, some of them were G drops. Mm. And they did have to call an ambulance or two. And others just needed to, you know, settle. But they've got an amazing eye.
Look, it's a remarkable project. They're all volunteers themselves from the dance community, which enhances their credibility.
Yeah.
But they're quite well-trained around first aid, around care for people. We work very closely with the formal first aid providers like St John's Ambulance. We've been working in partnership with VAC at TROF, the men's dance parties, the last three events. And I've worked with them, although I'm not as trained as they are, but they have very clear protocols around how they do assessments, what decisions they make about referring people on for further care, and they're remarkable.
And the questions they ask are really interesting. They actually, the way they ask them and is with care and compassion, and totally non-judgmental. And I guess the response they get is very different from a cop asking questions in that space.
Look, I've been with them when they have people approach, and it's particularly for younger people, it's quite common to hear them say, oh, you mean it's okay for me to talk to you about drugs? And it reveals that their anticipation is that someone is going to tell them off or warn them against it. And these are, you know, regular, ordinary people, but they just are surprised they can talk about it. When our people say yes, the conversation opens up.
And we've all had a friend and we've been at a dance party and they've dropped or they've gotten into some trouble. Are there tips that you guys give friends of these people to kind of help them through it?
Well, look, when the incident's actually happening, they will go into operation, and I've been involved in some of this myself. You know, we turn to the friend and we need to know what the person's taken. And you often will see a hesitation on the friend's face.
Sure.
Can I tell you? And we just make it really clear, look, we need to know so we can let them know or let the ambulance know, et cetera, if it's been called. But we also, when we do events, we put up a lot of posters and we try and let people know that we are there, that, for example, if it's around G, we put up posters around, be careful about how you use it. If you want to get some syringes from us for measuring, just ask us. So we try and create a broader awareness of being safe and promoting that.
Nothing kills a nightclub going off more than an ambulance in the middle of the dance floor.
Yes. So we set things up. We work with security to be able to get someone out of the crowded public space into a quiet space as soon as possible and where they can then be close to being outside.
It's never a good look if you've got, you know, three or four ambulances out the front of your nightclub.
Not at all.
There has been.
But the point is, you know, if someone drops from G, it can actually be very, very dangerous. And it's important that people know to call an ambulance and also to know that if that happens, the ambulance will not inform the police.
I had, that's an interesting point. But it leads me to telling your doctors and telling your nurses and that sort of stuff, which mm-hmm. we'll get to in a minute. But in the mid-90s, I went to a party, going-away party for a friend who was from the States. There were Americans that were at this party that were just sort of there for the occasion. And a friend of mine did pass out after spending time with these American guys. I had read an article in Attitude magazine from London about GBH. And I read it about three times. I just thought, this is a fascinating thing that's going on. It hadn't appeared here at that time.
Mm.
And when he dropped, I said, what has he had? And they told me, and I said, call an ambulance straight away. And he did stop breathing. And the ambulance didn't know what to do. Mm. They knew nothing of it. And this happens all the time when a new type of drug comes through. We've seen it how with these synthetics, some of the psychoses and things were never expected to the extent that they have been playing out.
And that's where our Dunsworth project is playing a really important role, because these are well connected to the community of emerging drugs. And so the police and ambulance people and the health department, who fund us, want to know what we are finding out, because then they can, in turn, be alert to it and respond appropriately. And by police, I mean forensics and people like that.
Sure.
But, I mean, all of the stuff I'm talking to you about now, I've heard from these often, you know, younger people.
And they're on the front
line. That
are
well connected. Yep. And they can tell you what's coming out. And because we formally work in partnership with ambulances and all these people, that communication is going on all the time.
I imagine they know straight away when there's a bad batch of something going through.
Yeah, and they're able to then put up, you know, some sort of notice or posters at an event and let people know.
You're with Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. Tim Little and Dean Beck with Bill O'Loughlin from Harm Reduction Victoria. Tonight, we talk about drugs.
Bill, you've been putting pen to paper somewhat lately. There was an article about these testing kits at dance parties, or this super-duper testing kit. But you also have been sticking it into the ICE action plan and perhaps the former Prime Minister's approach to the whole ICE epidemic.
Yes, I have.
Dare I call it an epidemic?
Yes, what happened was, I'll tell you the story. The government released their National ICE report, I think Sunday a week ago, and they did it with very suddenly, and they released it to key media, and they saturated the promotion by saying, we acknowledge that policing won't work and we need to invest more in treatment. So the response was, this is quite a shift. And I went home and I downloaded it and I read all 260 plus pages and I began to think, wait a minute, this is a bit strange. So then I reread all 260 very finely printed pages and came to the conclusion that three things. Number one is while they said that the policing has not worked, they still have a very extensive coverage of the policing that's needed.
It's where most of the money goes.
Yeah. And secondly, the stuff on treatment is actually really good. It really ramps up the need for treatment and recognises people get into trouble with ICE,
and etc. Early intervention on that space.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the third thing, and the thing they miss out on, is there is no attention to working with in the field of harm reduction. The Australian formal drug policy has three pillars: supply reduction, demand reduction, harm reduction. Mm-hmm. Supply reduction is cutting down the availability of drugs. Demand is educating people not to take them. Mm. And harm reduction is working with people who are using drugs to prevent them getting any harms. The National ICE Plan has no attention to harm reduction at all. And in fact, when it talks about it, it just talks about the harms. So in fact, I came to the conclusion it is extraordinarily old-fashioned, don't take drugs, and if you do take drugs, stop approach. And
how successful is that methodology, Bill?
Oh, it's absurd. I mean, look at the, you know, look out the window.
Working. Yeah, exactly. You know, look out the window.
It's that simplistic political response that politicians love, like Tony Abbott, who used to bang on all the time about, you know, the ICE epidemic, etc. It's headlining stuff. And it doesn't work. And what's disappointing is this has been portrayed as a very comprehensive, appropriate response to ICE. And in fact, it's framed around really old, ignorant understandings of drugs and what to do about them.
What also doesn't work is our health sector not acknowledging the extent to which it is an issue. Various agencies, and I point my finger at the HIV agencies particularly, refused to acknowledge for a long, long time that ICE was even in our community, let alone being responsible for many, many, many seroconversions. And it then sort of got to a point where I don't know whether the increases or the... It certainly wasn't the data, because the data still, I think, underreports as far as the extent to which it is prevalent in our community. But maybe it was that it's in the public domain with Abbott's ICE action plan that suddenly they did acknowledge it.
I think two things have happened. One of them was that the leadership of our LGBTI kind of organisation and sector are always wary of saying something that might portray our community in a bad light. So they don't want to be saying we have a drug problem, because it allows the broader community to look and say, oh, for example, you know, all those self-centered gay men are just, you know, getting drug fucked and da-da-da-da and being irresponsible. That's what gay men are like. So there's an element of resistance there. The second one was that a lot of what was happening around ICE was happening away from, was in a different subgroups to those who run the organisations and are in them. So they actually weren't coming into contact with it. They weren't seeing it, which is different to, like when we began the AIDS councils, for example, we were all in our 20s and 30s and we were off the street doing it. So we knew what we were talking about.
And your friends and next door neighbours were dying.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And we were out doing clubs and doing all that stuff. Now there's an older generation and it's more...
Are you suggesting that university-trained health educators aren't the
I would never say that. I'd lose half my friends. I think what happened was that the drug using culture, I'm going to talk about gay men because that's what I know about, became more underground, became more covert, became more secretive, and it became, and there's that stigma around drugs, there's that stigma around injecting. So those members, sort of prominent members of the community who got involved in it, and we all knew they were getting into trouble, there was also this ring of silence around that. So it happened on lots of levels.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it shifted in the last little while, but I agree with you that there's been a big silence both around the extent to which meth is being used or crystal is being used in the community, and also I think we need to talk about every drug according to the qualities of that drug and what happens. And I think there are some aspects of meth that mean that some people are getting into trouble, and the trouble they get into is really quite dramatic and very alarming for them.
Do you think that drug use has become more socially acceptable?
within our community. It's always been acceptable. But it's, I think it's been institutionalised. Yes, I do. I think there are certain events and dance parties where it's assumed that drugs are part of the experience.
I think it's been sexualised.
I was going to say, I think it's very much moved into being sexualised as well. And I think it's become much more complex to be gay these days than what it was back in my day.
do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we get off tangent here, but I think if you look at some events, the sense of what it means to be at the center of that event and to be really on and to be getting to be admired, it's about the body you've got, it's about the drugs you're taking, it's about the people you mix with and the drugs they take and who fucks who and all of that. And people from the outside see that, and it's like what you kind of want to aspire to that. It's natural.
Wasn't it always like that?
Oh, God, no. No, it was much simpler.
Really?
Yeah, much, much simpler. Yes.
Oh. Not like Studio 54.
Oh, look, back then, no. But back then you had speed, you had cocaine, and then ecstasy later on. Speed, you just went for a long, long time and you had really sore jaw from chewing gum and you had really bad sex because you just rubbed a lot and got frantic.
No hard on.
Yeah.
Fell off.
Cocaine was like short and exerting. And E was like lovely. So it was a simpler, and you had joints. It was simpler.
But I'm lucky enough to be just at the end of the dance party era with the big Mardi Gras parties and the big Red Roars and those sorts of things here locally. And those parties were fueled on E.
Yes.
And they were a 10,000 person love fest.
Yes, exactly.
And it was extraordinary.
Yes.
I hear these stories of aggro at parties all the time and like an edge to the aggro.
Mm.
And that's not E, as we knew it.
Yeah, look, that's a... If you want to talk about drugs in particular, there are some aspects to meth which will make people get edgy and tense and anxious and, at most extreme, psychotic. But the drug can backfire on people, particularly if they've used it for a while and used it heavily.
Now, I was going to ask you this question. Prolonged use does mean that you become more sensitive to it? You need less to send you sort of off your rocker?
No, that's what I seem to have witnessed. There are two things. One of them is prolonged use, the drug doesn't work on you as effectively. It affects the dopamine in the brain, etc., so the drug just doesn't kick in. So you don't get that effect. And I don't understand the physiological stuff, and I don't know that perhaps people do, but certainly what happens is there's a shift in what I observe in the people I know quite well who've had problems with it, is they will start to isolate. They will do more compulsive stuff, like they will just be online and on apps for hours. They'll be watching porn. You know, I've known of men whose penises have been raw because they've been masturbating
and
for days.
And they can't finish a sentence because their mind jumps around.
And their mind is all over the place and their emotions jump in and out, etc. And that's a state that I think people get into. Might be prolonged use, but when they then are using heavily as well.
Yes, I've witnessed that. I also witnessed people who have had prolonged breaks and got off it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tiniest little bit will send them back to that state.
Yes, and I know the same. I think one of the things that's most significant about meth is psychosis. And there are some people who say, oh, look, it's just a consequence of not enough sleep and you get a bit disoriented. I don't believe that. I think there's a very specific psychosis that comes with meth. There are very specific kinds of fears. Not everyone gets it, but I have seen men who have developed within a couple of hours, an hour or so of using, again, like you say, after having a break.
I got a phone call 2 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon. I just finished my show on Thursday here from a friend who lived here in the city in an apartment. And he said, can you come to my apartment? Which I'd never been to before. He'd always come to my place. And I went and let myself in, and he was lying on the shower recess of his shower, covering the plug, of course, because he was lying on it, and the water was building up through and cascading into his lounge room. But that aside, he was washing the bugs out of his veins, which he was well and truly convinced were there.
Yes.
And in a really bad state. Yes. And that took 3 hours for me to sort of calm him down and get him off the plug hole. And in the end, I rang actually Living Positive Victoria and asked one of the peer educators there, what is my next move? And they said, well, you've got two choices. You either get him to the hospital or you call an ambulance.
Mm.
I said that to him and he snapped out of it, went to bed, went to sleep.
Right. I mean, I've been in similar situations and their response is to look at me and think you are trying to... I've had a friend who's been in the casualty department at a major hospital for a day or so, lying in a room being treated, absolutely certain that the doctors and nurses outside the room were going to come in and kill him at any moment.
It's very real to them.
Yeah, and
it's
when people, yes, and when I've said to friends, I'm taking you to hospital, they look at me and I have to say, you have to trust me, because they're beginning to think, what's he up to? Mm. You know, I've had a friend who
took his laptop
apart because he thought it was telling him that it was spying on him. Another friend who spent the whole night lurking around Tullamarine Airport because he thought people were trying to kill him and he's ringing his sister interstate. I mean, it's florid psychosis. The other thing that I think that happens is, in the days and weeks afterwards, it can return in milder forms. And I don't think the psychiatrists and the clinicians see that. I see it in social interactions.
Oh.
And it'll be a flicker of an anxiety or a paranoia that's residual.
Jumping at things that aren't there or...
No, it will be about people. And why did you say that? What's going on there?
Oh, yes, yeah, right. Yes.
And
I
it's
have
not,
seen that. Yeah,
it's a subtle thing, but I've sort of eventually put two and two together. Mm. And it's my theory.
Well, I think there's a warning in that. What was your warning to Mr. Abbott and his ideas?
Oh,
get your shit
only
together.
One. I mean, it would be, you know, get the message and go away.
We are speaking with Bill O'Loughlin. He's the president of Harm Reduction Victoria. Dean Beck and Tim Little with you on Hide and Seek. Our guest, Bill O'Loughlin from Harm Reduction Victoria. Bill, we mentioned it before, but injecting drug use is more prevalent, it seems, in our community, the gay male community, than ever before.
Yeah, I think it's directly connected with meth. Well, I know it is. And it's because people are finding that the experience of using meth is enhanced if they inject.
Meaning more intense, meaning...
Yep, right. More intense, more immediate. The rush is so powerful.
Longer?
And, yes, it goes into the system quicker and it would be absorbed, I don't know. Actually, I don't know about longer, but right. I mean that just becomes a matter of, well, you'd have another one.
Right.
But I think what we're seeing is a development of people... Commonly, they will start smoking meth, and then as they get more exposure to people that are using it, they will often be offered, look, would you like me to hit you up, because it'd be fantastic. And often it'll be in a sexual situation with a partner who will be saying, look, I can promise you, you'll have the best sex ever if we do this.
Does that put more pressure on your heart, for example?
Oh, yes.
Because it's pumping through quicker?
Yep. The immediate impact hits you much faster that way. And, I mean, there's two discussions. One of them is around the use of meth and what people do. The other one is around the other physiological effects of using meth, Viagra, Amyl.
All of which have effects on the heart and the blood flow.
You know, yes, this is what I meant by back in the day, being gay was simpler. Now it's, you know, you do a lot of shopping before you have a good route.
One of the safest drugs that it turned out to
exactly,
be. You know. Oh, how funny.
So, yes, and it feels kind of a bit teacher-like to have to say, well, it does impact on your heart and it does affect your blood pressure and all that, but it does. And it's then a question of trying to help people to get some practices going around, you know, rest occasionally, keep the fluid up, eat something now and then, and just getting that part of what people
And I reckon practice. All that plays out in mental state as well, you know, blood sugar levels and hydration and all of that. Yes. I think it all plays out in the psychosis.
And I think people don't want to appear as though it's a bit sissy to have to stop and have a milkshake or a chocolate bar. You know, it's about I'm tough and I can do it and I'm on the go. It's stupid.
Bill, we have to wrap it up, and I could probably go on for another 2 hours, but JB would shoot me. So I'm going to have to say thank you very much for joining us on Hide and Seek. Would you come back and have another chat with us another day?
Certainly.
That would be great, because we have barely scratched the surface.
Exactly right.
Now, there's a couple of new resources out that we want to point your attention to. The Institute of Many is currently doing a harm reduction resource for gay men who have HIV and use crystal meth. It's called Turning Tina, and that can be found at theinstituteofmany.org. And VAC's Touch Base resource, you've had a little look at it, Bill?
Yes, yeah, we were involved on it. It's fantastic. And I'll say this, it's actually a well-designed website. It surprises you where it takes you, and it gives you little film clips and songs, and it's a really entertaining experience.
It's actually a very complex website that has been beautifully executed to make it look so simple.
Yep.
Yeah, yes. It's very clever. And your own website, Bill?
Harm Reduction Victoria, where I feature on the front page and the second page and the third page and the fourth page.
Hey, you got a gong from VAC the other day. What was that about?
Oh, we more than a gong, we got a crystal monument in recognition
of the
partnership that VAC and Harm Reduction Victoria has.
See, they sell a $15 million building and now they can buy monuments. Yeah. I love it.
We've hocked it already at Harm Reduction Victoria.
on the measly pickings that you get, you'd have to. We've got to go. Tim, thank you very much for co-hosting tonight.
Thank you. It's been very informative.
Thank you very much, Bill, for joining us on Hide and Seek. I'm Dean Beck. You can follow me on Twitter at Dean Beck on Air. Till next time, you keep well, take care, and bye for now.
Hide and Seek. Joy 94.9.
You can subscribe to Hide and Seek's podcast for free. Visit joy.org.au/hideandseek for more information. Suggest a topic, a guest, or provide feedback. Email hideandseek@joy.org.au.
Hide and Seek.
Hide and Seek.
Hide and Seek.
Hide and Seek.
Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.